Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. The Other Side of Midnight presents The Midnight Files.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride, filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it to tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you? Midnight in the desert, and we're listening. Ooh, we're listening to you.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. It is no secret that we have covered UFOs or UAPs, whatever you want to call them, a great deal. We have had every possible variety of guest on this subject. We have had people who are so skeptical about the concept that they believe the very idea of intelligent life anywhere other than Earth is something better suited for a Star Trek episode. And we've had people who claim they were abducted multiple times. They're on a first name basis with multiple alien species. There have been people who claim that the U.S. government is hiding alien aircraft and in some cases even alien bodies. And we talk to people who believe the folks at the Pentagon are just as in the dark about this as we are. We've had journalists on and we've had people who proudly proclaim themselves debunkers. One thing that many of them have had in common, though, is that they so often cite the work of one man. In part, it's because his Ivy League academic credentials are above reproach. And in part, it's because depending on where you are on the question of UAPs or UFOs, there's something in his work that you can point to which may bolster your argument. A few years ago, Avi Loeb, who is a professor of science at Harvard University, in fact, he's the longest serving chair of Harvard's Department of Astronomy, he made international headlines by saying that he thought that the comet Oumuamua might actually be an alien probe. Now, he's got a new book out in which he details his journey to, of all places, the bottom of the ocean to prove or to attempt to prove extraterrestrial contact. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the program the founding director of Harvard's Black Hole Initiative, the head of the Galileo Project, a New York Times bestselling author, and the author of the latest book, of the newest book, Interstellar, The Search for Extraterrestrial Life and Our Future in the Stars, Professor Avi Loeb. Professor Loeb, it's great to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Let's give people a little bit of background with your journey that led to this book. I mentioned your work with Oumuamua. We've spoken about that before. That was a comet which you said didn't look like a lot of other comets that we encounter regularly. Why does this metal at the bottom of the ocean that you write about in Interstellar matter? And why did you think it might matter?
Well, this was actually the very first object that was from outside the solar system discovered by humans. And it collided with Earth back on January 8, 2014. And the fireball that was created as a result of its friction with air was spotted by U.S. government satellites. And what was unusual about it is it was moving very fast, much faster than necessary to escape from the solar system. And so the conclusion that we drew 5 years later was that this indeed came from interstellar space. But moreover, the U.S. Government released the data about where it exploded above the Pacific Ocean, and we were able to conclude that its material strength was higher. It was tougher than all space rocks, 272 of them, that were cataloged by NASA over the past decade. And because it was fast and very tough, it came to my mind that it could be a Voyager-like meteor. Just imagine our own spacecraft leaving the solar system and colliding with a planet like Earth far away. It would appear as a meteor of unusual material strength and speed. And to find out what this object was made of, I led an expedition to the Pacific Ocean, and we were able to collect the molten fragments from the surface of this object when it exploded in the atmosphere. They were collected from the bottom of the Pacific Ocean, about a mile deep, across a region of 7 miles in size. These particles were a millimeter in size, roughly the size of a grain of sand. And it was very challenging to find them, but we did bring the material back to Harvard University and analyzed it with the best mass spectrometer that the world has to offer. And we realized that those extra particles that were found along the meteor path had a composition that was never seen in the solar system, not on Earth, not on the moon or on Mars or asteroids. So we concluded that for two reasons, one, the speed of the object, and the second is the composition. This is the first interstellar object that humanity discovered. And the next step is to decide whether it was technological in origin or natural. And a simple way to tell that is by finding a big piece of the object, which we intend to do in an expedition over the coming year. So a follow-up to the previous one. We will use different tools to find those big pieces, and obviously we will be able to tell the difference between a rock and a technological gadget, because the gadget may have buttons on it or screws, and we would be able to say perhaps what its purpose was.
Well, and that leads me to my next question, which I guess is the most obvious one. Just because an object is from outside the solar system, how do we know if it's alien technology? Couldn't it have been just a naturally occurring meteor from outside the solar system?
Yes. So one approach that we took already is to examine the composition, the material making of what came from this object. And for example, just imagine molten droplets from semiconductors or from computer screens. They would have abundances of elements that are very different than what you find in rocks, because semiconductors use specific elements that are rare in nature. And indeed, we found in the analysis that we did, we found some elements that are more abundant than solar system materials by factors of 100. These are elements like beryllium, lanthanum, uranium. We call this composition Belau for these elements. But it's unclear whether that is because it was used for technological purpose or because it's natural from some very unusual origin. And in the paper that we wrote, we mentioned that it could have originated from a planet that has a molten magma, a magma ocean. Basically, the rock is melted on the surface of that planet. Then you can separate elements, and those that we find will be more likely to be on the surface of the object. And the other elements will sink towards an iron core near the center because they have affinity to iron. So there is a natural process that could give you the kind of composition that we discovered from outside the solar system. But obviously, if we find a big piece, we will be able to tell.
Your process for digging up this material, this metal at the bottom of the ocean, the expedition sounds like it could be a movie in and of itself. And I know you cover it in the book Interstellar. Tell folks how you went about acquiring these materials.
Right. Actually, there is a movie.
Of course there is.
There were actually of the order of 50 filmmakers and producers who approached me before the expedition. They wanted to be on the ship. I chose one. So it will be hopefully out to the public within a year or two. But the first challenge was to get funded, because this expedition cost us $1.5 million. And I just announced it after we had the government data on this meteor. And within a few months, Charles Hoskinson came forward, and I didn't know him. He arranged a Zoom meeting with me and said, you have the money. So that allowed us to move forward. And I recruited a team of about 28 individuals. They are the best among ocean expedition leaders, and some engineers, some navigators, and so forth. We built a sled with magnets on both sides that we dragged on the ocean floor with the ship. It was connected by a cable that was 3 miles long. Now, the first challenge in the first day was to keep the sled on the ocean floor, and it would basically get lifted by the cable and was kiting above the ocean floor. And then the engineers realized that if we go with the current, they can keep it on the ocean floor. So we started collecting materials, but most of the material was black powder, basically volcanic ash, that is of no interest to us. And after the sixth day, I wrote a diary report. I wrote 43 diary reports that were read by millions of people around the world. They were posted on medium.com. And they were translated to Spanish. And on the sixth day, I said, where are the spherules? These are the molten droplets that we were after, because we didn't find them yet. And the expedition was 14 days long. So it was sort of near the middle of the trip. And then we started filtering out the volcanic ash by using a mesh. And then we took the bigger particles, put them under a microscope, and then lo and behold, we found the first spherule. And I hugged the person who found it. Basically, I was thrilled, because I knew that if you find an ant in the kitchen, there must be many more out there. And sure enough, altogether, we found 50 of them on the boat. But when we brought the materials back to Harvard, a summer intern of mine, Sophie Bergstrom, found more than 600 additional ones. So we have right now about 700 of them.
Wow. I mean, that's remarkable. I'm going to ask you a question. If people are just tuning in, we're talking with Professor Avi Loeb of Harvard. He's got a new book out talking about this discovery and this quest. It's called Interstellar, The Search for Extraterrestrial Life and Our Future in the Stars. The question that I have may be impossible for you to answer, but I'm going to go ahead and ask it anyway. Do you have a theory as to whether the alien intelligence that's responsible for these metal droplets at the bottom of the ocean, if it is an alien intelligence, do you have a theory as to whether or not that's the same alien intelligence that may have sent the Oumuamua probe, or do you think it might be something different?
We don't know. I mean, probably different, because there are so many stars in the Milky Way galaxy. There are tens of billions of them, and who knows whether one came together with the other. Oumuamua was not moving very fast in the frame of the Milky Way galaxy. In fact, it was like a buoy sitting at rest, and then the solar system bumped into it like a giant ship. And this object, on the other hand, outside the solar system, was moving very fast, faster than 95% of the stars. It probably came from another origin based on its speed. Oumuamua was flat in its shape. I suggested that it was pushed by reflecting sunlight. And 3 years later, there was an object found that was reflected by, was reflecting sunlight and was pushed as a result of that. And it ended up being a rocket booster that NASA launched in 1966. It had thin walls that are made of stainless steel, and it didn't evaporate, just like Oumuamua, didn't show any cometary tails. So my suggestion was that Oumuamua, just like 2020SO, this object from NASA, was artificial in origin, but it probably served a completely different purpose than any object like this meteor, because this meteor might be just space trash, the kind of meteor that Voyager would be once it exits the solar system. It will not be functional anymore, and it's not flat in its shape. So there could be different types of interstellar objects, and I don't think they are related, the two of them.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Well, that's helpful.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You've been looking openly in a very scientific, serious manner for extraterrestrial life for a few years now. You had a stellar academic career, longest serving chair of Harvard's Department of Astronomy, founding director of Harvard's Black Hole Initiative. I don't know of many astronomers in academia with more credibility than you do. I'm curious. The issue of searching for extraterrestrial life has, at least until recently, been viewed as somewhat fringe by mainstream sections of society. I'm curious, are you looked at any differently these days by your Harvard colleagues than before you started openly working on this stuff?
No, I don't feel that. I have a group of students and postdocs working with me, and people who know me recognize that I haven't changed. It's just that I find this frontier to be of great interest because the public cares about it. And I'm trying to advocate for common sense. You know, humanity launched probes to space, and just imagine other technological civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy doing the same. And all we are doing is checking if we can find any packages in our backyard or near our mailbox. That's all. And to me, this makes a lot of sense. I don't see that as any as an idea that is more fringe than speaking about extra dimensions or the multiverse or string theory that are quite popular. I don't feel any direct issues with people that surround me at Harvard or elsewhere that I interact all the time, except for a few people that keep repeating insults. Two reporters. One from Arizona State University. And, you know, the problem they have is they are used to the idea that anything in the sky, any object in the sky that comes to Earth must be a rock or a stone, because these are the typical meteors from the solar system. And they would say that the U.S. government data must be wrong because you cannot fit the data that the U.S. Space Command provided with a model for a stone. And I say, you know, you should respect the U.S. Space Command. They actually went back and checked their data and confirmed the assertion that this is an interstellar object. So you better change your model. Maybe this object is not a stone. But instead, these people are very arrogant. They say the data is wrong. They say that what I'm doing, it does not follow the scientific method, where I'm actually doing exactly what it asks for. I'm going to the Pacific Ocean, putting a lot of effort, trying to collect materials, evidence, then studying it. That's exactly the scientific method. Those people are sitting on their chairs and making negative comments all the time and attacking me personally, which I, you know, I find non-scientific. And I think their problem should be dealt with by their therapists. not by me. And the other thing I would say is that I'm really struck by the fact that childlike bullying is more prevalent for this community of people than childlike curiosity.
Right.
Because, you know, I'm just curious, and they are just bullying all the time, keep repeating. And reporters pay attention to them because it makes their stories more clickbait receptive. So a lot of people like controversy, but it's not controversial at all. I'm following the scientific method, and these people are just expressing negative comments.
Speaking of therapy, I think he was at Harvard before you joined the faculty there. I'm wondering if you can empathize at all with John Mack, who was a Harvard psychiatrist and professor. I think he might have even been the head of the Department of Psychiatry. And he interviewed a lot of people who claimed that they'd been abducted by aliens. And he found that in his experience that they were telling the truth. And he had said before he passed away that he had become something of a pariah. I'm glad to see that's not the case with you. Did you know John Mack at all?
No, I didn't know him. And there is a fundamental difference between the approach that he and I are taking, because he was basing anything he said on what he hears from humans, from people. And I don't trust you people because they have ulterior motives. They can hallucinate, imagine things. You know, when there is a car accident, people involved give you completely different reports. FIFA, you know, in the U.S., in the Soccer World Cup, did not, when there was a decision to be made by the referee, they did not ask the players, did the ball cross the line of the goal? They went to use video cameras that provided them with the data. And that is the way science is done in physics. You don't rely on what people say. You use instruments to infer what is happening, because, you know, people can tell you anything. And John Mack, on the other hand, he just focused on people. So if someone said, I experienced this and that, he would pay attention. That will be his data. For me, it doesn't carry any water.
Understood.
So, so that's a major difference. And as a result, he could have been fooled by people who say the same thing, but all of them had no such experience in reality. And they all imagine things. And for me, that's irrelevant anyway, because, you know, in the Galileo Project, we have a set of instruments measuring things in the sky, taking images. And in the context of this meteor, we went there, collected materials, and studied it with instruments.
Let me end with this, Professor Loeb, and I appreciate you being so generous with your time. The government has made a big deal about issuing these reports where they're claiming to declassify UAP material. Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, is backing legislation to declassify even more of this. Congress has been very, very vocal about sort of revamping the process for reporting UAPs, as has NASA. Is this a big deal? Is this helpful to your efforts at determining what's out there?
Definitely, because it's possible that the U.S. government has information or materials that are far better than what we know. And their day job is to monitor the sky all the time for national security purposes. And every now and then they might see something unusual. You know, astronomers look at a small piece of the sky and they usually focus on very distant sources. So if something flies overhead, they ignore it. So it's possible the government has data, and the fact that serious politicians consider it seriously, I think it's a great plus, because maybe we will get access to that data or materials if they exist. I don't know that they exist because they were never released to my attention. And as a scientist, I would be delighted to help government figure out the nature of things that came from outside the solar system and what they tell us about our neighbors.
Professor Avi Loeb, I really appreciate the time. I appreciate the work you're doing even more. People can read about it in Interstellar, The Search for Extraterrestrial Life and Our Future in the Stars. Thank you so much, sir.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to comment on any portion of our discussion, you're welcome to give me a call, 800-848-9222. That's 800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.